Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Chris O'Brien, business and technology columnist for the San Jose Mercury News, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Robert Vimosi, contributing editor of PC World and author of When Gadgets Betray Us. Mr. Vimosi has over a decade of experience in the security field. He's currently a senior analyst at Mokana, a gadget security device company. And besides being an author, he's also a noted blogger at Fords.com.
Thank you, Chris. So at the very end of the movie Annie Hall, Woody Allen has this little monologue that he gives as his character, Alvy Singer. And in that monologue, he has a joke. And the joke is, guy goes in to see his psychiatrist and says, my brother's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken. And the doctor says, that's terrible. Have you turned him in? And the guy says, I would, but we need the eggs. I bring that up because that's sort of how I feel about our approach to technology. We know that these gadgets that we have in our lives are pretty crazy and do crazy things about our security and our privacy and messages, and we get hacked from time to time, and yet we need the eggs. We like the convenience. At no other point in history have we been where you can walk down the street and still be close to your friends and family. You can communicate with them. You can text. You can call. You can see pictures of them. You can download videos from YouTube. And we love that convenience. But we sometimes forget in that process that there's a subtle trade-off going on. Someone may be tracking where you go on the internet. They might be tracking where you walk. There's often location services now with the smartphones that we have. So I have, as I just showed you, I have a HTC Thunderbolt, which just came out, and I also have an Apple iPhone. And I brought these because there are two different approaches going on here. One, of course, is that this isn't really a phone anymore. Yeah, I can make phone calls with it, but I can do so many other things with it. And in fact, since I bought this 2 weeks ago, I've probably used the internet and other services more than I've actually used it to make a phone call. So what we have is really a new computer, a computer that we need to get used to and think about as a computer. We need to think about updating it, and we need to think about the security issues that we've learned happen when you go on the internet with our desktop and our laptop computers. They're going to be happening now with our phones. Our mobile devices, excuse me. So what I want to point out here is that we've had 20 years of experience now downloading applications, and in that process on a desktop, you're often confronted with a message. It's the end-user license agreement, and most of us blow right through it and don't even look at it. It's just, yeah, I want to play Angry Birds, and you hit install. And in there might be some messages that warn you in advance that by accepting the agreement, you're telling other people certain pieces of information, like maybe you gave your address and your phone number in registering the product. That might be sold to someone else. My point is that we haven't really learned from those 20 years of experience. We now have new gadgets coming into our lives, and we're doing the same thing again. Now, Apple has an interesting approach. When I download an app from the App Store, I'm trusting that somebody in Cupertino has looked at that application and has decided that it has a certain level of security and offers a certain level of privacy. And by trusting Apple, I'm trusting the application that I'm downloading. Google, on the other hand, is open source. The Android operating system on here is open source, and that means anyone can look at the code and they can modify it and they can make their own versions of it. And so their approach to the application is you can do whatever you want and put it on our market, relatively speaking, and our operating system will stop you at the moment of installation and inform the end user This application is going to use location services. This application is going to contact your contact list. It's going to tell you in advance. And you know what? We still hit install because we want to play Angry Birds. So I just wanted to mention that I just wanted to say that we still just want the eggs. We recognize the dangers, but we proceed. And so with that, the title of tonight's talk was on mobile security. And so I'm going to read a chapter intro that talks about some recent problems that we've had with mobile security. It's a very hot day. Oh, actually, I discussed this. I'm going to use my phone. So most readers, I'm sure, most authors probably start with the book and read from pages of the book. You've probably seen authors do that. And now, you know, we have these lovely gadgets called Kindles, and you can get books that way too. I'm going to go a step further, and I actually have Kindle on my phone now. And so I'm going to read chapter 3 from my phone. It's a very hot day in July 2010. And standing in front of the crowded ballroom in the Riviera Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, researcher Chris Padgett is well aware of the illegal nature of his latest demonstration, although, with his vaguely British accent, he keeps making light of the situation. On stage, surrounded by computer and electrical antennas that cost about $1,500, Padgett is attempting to emulate the signal from the Global System for Mobile, or GSM, base station to attract nearby phones to his gadget instead. This will allow him to eavesdrop on any mobile phone conversations taking place in the room. On the advice of his lawyers, he has posted signs in the hallway informing attendees of his intentions. He has already heard from one U.S. carrier. AT&T will not sue to prevent this live demonstration at the annual security conference known as DEF CON. But the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, whose representatives might be in the ballroom, has not indicated what it will do when Padgett attempts to interrupt the legitimate signals from nearby towers to record mobile phone conversations of those in the room. Depending upon the FCC's definition of jamming, Padgett could be breaking the law. Padgett's live demonstration was to culminate a year-long research project. 7 months earlier, in the cold, dark week between Christmas and New Year's, Padgett and his German colleague, Carsten Null, both from a company called Hardware, were invited by the Chaos Computer Club, one of Europe's larger hacker communities, to speak at the annual Chaos Communications Congress held at the Berliner Congress Center in Berlin, Germany. On the first day of the 26C3 conference, Noel and Padgett presented their talk called GSM, Seriously?, in which they identified a number of significant flaws within the A51 encryption standard used for both short messaging service, SMS, and voice messages by the most common cellular phone technology in the world, GSM. They claimed that A51 encryption could be defeated with today's technology. A5 gives a good example of how we task old standards with new technology needs. A51 was first introduced in 1988 and is still in use today. Researchers first cracked the A51 in 1998, and 1 year later they cracked A52, a replacement algorithm from both, and then A53, which is entirely different from A51 and A52, has yet to be deployed worldwide. Noel and Padgett decided to rally against the GSM industry, which continues to use the weaker and academically broken A5s. It must be noted that breaks within A5 don't necessarily apply to how GSM cellular networks implement the encryption. New flavors of third generation GSM, such as General Packet Radio Services, GPRS, and enhanced data rates for GSM Evolution, also known as EDGE, have made communications a bit more secure. But Padgett maintains that there is not even the pretense of security in GSM. For example, A51 is not as secure as other forms of encryption, such as the Data Encryption Standard, DES, and Advanced Encryption Standard, AES, both of which have since been replaced with TripleDES and AES 256 today. Now that we're asking our mobile phones to handle banking and some e-commerce, shouldn't we make sure the platforms are secure first? Standards should be strengthened to accommodate our growing need for mobile commerce. Even the internet currently based on a standard known as Internet Protocol Version 4, ratified in 1981, was not designed for e-commerce, yet we buy and sell on the Internet today. As we saw in previous chapters, networks can be segmented, but more often bundled together, such as those we saw in hotel rooms, becoming more complex as needs evolve. This is no less true with our cellular networks we have today. Perhaps you've seen ads for competing cellular services stating that they have the fastest 3G network or introducing the fourth generation of 4G networks. What does that mean? Well, first generation or 1G refers to technology available circa 1980. Those early networks and handsets were analog and used a variety of mobile standards, some of which are no longer in use today. In 1991, the second generation 2G network was introduced, a digital network with two standards, GSM and Qualcomm's Code Division Multiple Access, or CDMA, were introduced. Both GSM and CDMA include SMS, unstructured supplementary services data, and other simple communication protocols. Of the two standards, CDMA is considerably harder to eavesdrop upon. CDMA doesn't send its radio signals intact, but it divides the signal over a range of channels. The receiver then takes these individual packets and reconstructs the original message. Designed for the military, CDMA provides secure communications that separates users by generating random codes that are never transmitted. Adding encryption makes intercepting CDMA call virtually impossible. Dominant in North America, CDMA is used by Sprint and Verizon in the United States. GSM, on the other hand, is used by 80% of the world's mobile phones. In the United States, T-Mobile and AT&T use GSM. So why are most of the GSM networks in the world still using a weak and vulnerable A51 when A53 is much better and harder to break? First, said Noel, not every country uses encryption. For example, India and China do not encrypt their GSM networks. Second, the GSM Association has found that upgrading all the cellular towers and network equipment to accommodate the additional resources needed for the additional encryption isn't always feasible. For example, in 2004, when critical vulnerability was found in A52, cellular operators in South America, Africa, and other parts of Asia required about 18 months to upgrade to more secure equipment. Upgrading everyone in the world to support A53 standard will not be any easier. Well, in the summer of 2009, Noel called upon his fellow researchers to help generate all the possible A51 encryption codes used by the phone carriers. Up until now, researchers could not replicate all the computation cycles used by the phone carriers to compute all the different variations of the encryption keys used in A51. But by using a distributed table generation method, Noel and Paget got individuals from all over the world to contribute minutes of spare computer time. And within 6 months, by December 2009, the two had assembled a comprehensive lookup table of all the possible values for A51 encryption in the GSM network. The resulting table, known as a rainbow table, is large. It's over 2 terabits in size. This is unwieldy for most, nor does it allow fast lookup. So Noel spent the next few months working on ways to make his lookup table even more efficient and found a method that allowed him to store only the input and output, chaining all the other possible combinations elsewhere. This resulted in a much lighter and faster rainbow table, which he debuted at Black Hat USA, a security conference, in July 2010. In his demonstration, Noel showed that an encrypted string of numbers captured from his own mobile phone conversation on his way to the base station he controlled in his lab could then be de-encrypted in a matter of a minute or so he could play his voice for the live audience. A few days later, Paget's DEF CON demo would take things even further. Paget planned to stream and decrypt live conversations captured over the GSM network. So how would that work? Mobile phones use radio waves to transmit and receive data as telephone conversations and text messages. Many of the same principles that affect traditional radios also apply to Wi-Fi and mobile phones. For example, anyone can transmit on a particular channel, so it's difficult for a receiver to know if the transmission is legitimate or spoofed. Before Noel and Paget each spoke at Black Hat and DEF CON, another researcher, known as the Grug, showed how to spoof signals to a legitimate GSM base station using only an inexpensive and reprogrammed GSM mobile handset. Whenever a mobile phone call is made, the Grug said, the handset establishes a handshake with the nearest cell tower, except GSM phone networks lack mutual authentication. That means a mobile handset authenticates itself to the network that says, I have a chip that allows me to access your network, but the network doesn't have to authenticate the mobile handset. It doesn't have to say, yes, I am the proper network for your handset. So the mobile handset must provide a secret key to the cell tower to gain permission to talk to the network, but the network never has to prove its own legitimacy. That lack of mutual authentication creates some interesting opportunities. The Grug showed how he could use this inexpensive GSM-enabled phone to wreak all sorts of havoc on nearby GSM base stations. For example, if one knew the unique identifier assigned to a particular mobile phone, the unique code that each mobile phone user has, one could tell the network that that phone's owner had disconnected. Then, repeatedly send that disconnect signal so that that person would stay off the network. Phones send out a signal called an International Mobile Subscriber Identity, or IMSI. The IMSI lives in the subscriber identity module, or SIM card, which is the chip that's moved from handset to handset when you upgrade your phone. The IMSI is broadcast to the network every so many seconds to let the network know where you are and whether you're still powered up. The attack that the Grug outlined sends out an IMSI detach command for your specific phone. The network, seeing that you have detached, sends all other incoming calls to voicemail. So no incoming calls would be lost. You just won't be able to make any outgoing calls, resulting in what's called a denial of service attack against your phone. Conversely, you could use the Grug's attack to send a request to connect, or what's called an IMSI attach command, with no follow-up. This floods the base station or cell tower with requests to hold open the channel while waiting for the proper response that will never come. By exhausting all the open channels, you could prevent anyone from connecting to the base station, creating what's called a denial of service attack against not only one phone, but all the phones in the given area. And the Grug said that he did this by accident at work, and the company was without cellular service for a day. So the police in Europe use a device that works similarly to this. It's called an IMSI catcher. And the intent is to capture the IMSIs, not to deny service. An IMSI catcher is a form of a base station. Because the IMSI catcher signal is stronger than the nearest tower, the mobile phones will attempt to connect through the IMSI catcher first. Once the IMSI catcher records the initial request, it lets go of the call, so the handset is free to connect to the real base station. Using the captured IMSIs, the police then work with the carriers to identify those who may have attended a political rally. However, the Grug's IMSI flood attack would thwart the IMSI catcher by flooding the IMSI catcher with bogus calls. At DEF CON, Padgett's base station wanted his base station to complete the mobile phone handshake so that he could intercept a live call. He would further connect his base station to a live network base station and perform what's known as a man-in-the-middle attack, forcing all the calls to be passed through his machine, but he chose not to do that. To circumvent some of the legal issues, Padgett broadcasts his GSM base station at 300 megahertz. This happens to be a ham radio frequency, and Padgett happens to be a ham radio operator. In the DEF CON demo, he told the base station to emulate AT&T's signal, and about two dozen phones then connected to Padgett's system instead of the nearest legitimate AT&T tower in Las Vegas. During the demo, Padgett broadcast a message telling the cellular customer that his or her call would be recorded. After the talk, Padgett destroyed the USB containing all the recordings made with a pair of scissors. Padgett's demonstration only works on 2G networks. To lure 3G-enabled GSM phones, however, he simply jams the 3G signal, which forces the handset to connect at the lower 2G signal. Here, legacy systems play into criminals' hands. Padgett's advice? Turn off the 2G on 3G phones, if possible. But that would also mean a loss of service should you ever go out of a 3G area. When connecting a handset to a cellular network, the base station currently chooses what level of encryption will be used. In his demonstration, Padgett simply turned off A5 encryption. The GSM networks are supposed to inform you when that encryption is not in use, he said, adding that most carriers turn that message off anyway. After Padgett's talk, the GSM Association told Forbes.com, the overall advice for GSM calls and fixed line calls is the same. Neither has offered a guarantee of secure communications. The great majority of users will make calls with no reason to fear that anyone might be listening. However, users with especially high security requirements should consider adding extra end-to-end security features over the top of both their fixed line calls and their mobile calls, end quote. If the mobile phone conversations can be intercepted without your knowing, what are other gadgets capable of? And what other personal information might we be leaking? So the book goes on, and I talk about more than just mobile phones. I talk about automobiles. Not many people realize that since about 2000, domestic cars in the United States have had black boxes, and they record the final minutes before a crash, whether you hit the brake, whether you had your seatbelt on, how fast you were going, and that data is stored. And this also came out when Toyota had its recent problems with the accelerator pedal. It was found that some of the black boxes actually used a proprietary standard, and it made it very hard for the federal government to look at those boxes. They actually had to get Toyota people over here to look at them. I also talk about gadgets that affect us personally. For example, medical implanted devices, pacemakers and such, they have chips in them, and they can be programmed. And in some cases, those are now being linked to the internet, and that's out of convenience. So you don't have to go and have it recalibrated at a medical facility. It can be done remotely. Well, if it can be accessed by the internet, you probably want to make sure that there's some layers of security there, firewalls and other. So in the book, I go through a number of different examples that you probably wouldn't think of as having chips. The clipper cards that are now being used in the Bay Area for transit, they have RFID tags in them. And what the danger there might be is that they're recording every time you go in and out of a BART station, every time you ride Muni. And from what I can tell, they're keeping that data forever. And the point of them keeping that data, they tell me, is that you might come back and challenge them at some point and say, you know, I never took that trip. And this is also true with the fast track on the cars. When you go over a toll road, it records that you're there, and you can look at your statement at the end of the month and you say, hey, I didn't go to San Rafael on that day. I didn't make that trip over the Bay Bridge. And you can counter it, and they keep those records forever. Well, what's happening is that lawyers are realizing that this is valuable information. And there was a Contra Costa Times report that I cite in the book that had data showing that lawyers were representing companies that wanted to find out if their employees really were working from home or if they were skipping out in the middle of the afternoon, or divorce lawyers that were looking to build a case against a spouse and establishing a pattern of behavior looking at these records. And what's different about cell phone records is that it's very, very hard to subpoena those records and to get a lawyer access to your cellular records. But it's relatively easy to get your fast track and clipper card information. It's relatively unprotected, and at the moment, judges are signing right over. So these are things I talk about in the book, and I really look forward to your questions tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. As a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Famosi, contributing editor of PC World and author of When Gadgets Betray Us. Robert, I really enjoyed the book and admire your reading. Your eyes must be far better than mine at this point. I need at least a tablet to be able to do that, I think.
Well, those handsets are backlit, so they're pretty bright.
Yeah. Let's stay on the topic of mobile here and mm-hmm. and then move on to some other parts of the book. You know, one of the things that strikes me as someone who's bought many mobile phones at this point is that when I'm shopping for them, there's a lot of features, a lot of comparisons out there to help me figure out things like processor speed or various other features like the camera, you know, fun things I can do with it. I rarely see in those comparisons information about security. Is it pretty tough for me to sort of assess the phones as a consumer based on their security that's built in, or is that out there and I'm just not seeing it?
It's not out there. It's very, very hard to assess the security of almost any gadget that I talk about in the book. There's not, for one, a central standard that we're laying out. I'll use an example from the financial services space. There's what they call PCI, and when you swipe your credit card at a cash register, the merchant, the bank, the acquirer, all the people that are involved in that transaction have to abide by these 12 requirements and sub-requirements, and there's an industry standard out there for that. When you get to electronics, and in particular with software, you don't have that. And when I was a reviewer at CNET for many years and reviewing software, I would say, as a security person, I want a good housekeeping seal of approval. I want to have some independent body. It can be a government body. It can be a collection of vendors that agree that certain standards are met and that this product has that seal of approval. So when I walk into Best Buy or when I go somewhere, I'm looking at that symbol. We're accustomed to seeing the UL listed, the Underwriters Laboratory mark, and we know that that electronic device probably will not blow up on us or blow a fuse in our house because it's been tested and it's been certified by some independent body. And when it comes to gadgets, we don't yet have that, and particularly with security.
So do you get the sense then that the companies, even if they're not making it easy for us to find out about that, and even if it's very complex, are they internally taking this seriously and working toward making things more secure, or whether we're talking about the gadgets or the network providers, or is that still something that they know they can kind of let slide because we're not likely to make buying decisions based on those things?
I think they're taking it seriously. You have an audience that's trying these devices out, and word of mouth is very important. The iPhone caught on because everybody had a cool experience with the iPhone. And if somebody had a bad experience, that would negatively impact Apple. So I think they are taking it very seriously. And when security issues are brought up, different companies react very differently, but I do think that they're listening to the concerns that are met. You indicated I now work for a device security company, and I know that the names of the companies that my company is now talking to are pretty high up, and they're taking this seriously. This is something that you won't actually see, but my hope is that someday you'll be able to buy a mobile phone, and it'll say on the box that it's been independently certified as meeting certain standards.
Let's also just talk then briefly about the app world, which you mentioned in your reading, because, you know, I've gone out in my job and I've had a chance to meet a lot of the folks who make that. I mean, Apple now has hundreds of thousands of these apps in their store. And, you know, some of them are very large companies sort of transferring their web product to an app. Some of it's just a couple guys on a laptop banging out a neato application and selling it for a couple bucks in the Apple's in the iTunes store. Are we sort of still stuck in that same way in terms of finding out about this? Because, you know, it struck me you mentioned the terms of service. I mean, I couldn't tell you from square one how I find, you know, the terms of service for Zombie Farm.
Right, and these apps are coming out so quickly. There are some security companies that are focusing just on the mobile, and what they're currently doing is looking at those permissions that I mentioned. They're looking to see what the app is accessing on the phone and reporting it back to you. So if you missed it at the moment that you installed it, there are apps such as Lookout Mobile Security is one that you could download, and it will tell you the security settings of most of the apps that you have. And that's I think, a Band-Aid approach. I mean, it's great for the moment, but ultimately we should be baking in the security at the earliest possible level, at the moment that the program is written, at the moment that the chip is created, and then we don't have to worry about bolting it on later as an afterthought. And the more that awareness is out there, and the more the dialogue starts with consumers and manufacturers and software vendors, I think we'll get to that point. But we're still at a very, very early point in all of this.
And let's not let ourselves off the hook here, because I think you framed it very well, both in your talk and in the book, that we're doing a poor job of thinking and talking about this ourselves and educating ourselves. And again, it's an age old problem going back decades now, where we're maybe not striking the right balance between convenience of these things and really thinking about the security or thinking about these issues. And what I always come back to on that question is, when you see companies that, in the instances where they take that issue really seriously and they give you a lot of tools, they find that people are just not likely to employ them. And this goes for really any service where it requires us to do a lot of setup, to get in the front door. And so, Facebook is a very good example of this. When they had very complex controls that were very granular, they found that people didn't spend a lot of time setting them. And so now they've tried to simplify them, but then they sort of get hit in the other direction saying, well,
we can't see what you're doing on the back end.
Right.
Right.
So let's stay with us, though, for a second.
Sure.
It sounds like we're not getting better at making that balance, but is there anything that either industry can do or that we can be doing to tip that balance in a better favor?
Well, we're focusing a lot on software. We're focusing a lot on the internet tonight. But in the book, I try to broaden that. Auto safety, for example, there's over 70 discrete computer systems in the average car today, and a lot of them lack authentication, meaning that there's a little port under the steering column, and that's a diagnostic port. It's required by law, and it's there for your mechanic to hook some equipment up so they can read the computers on your car and diagnose what's wrong. It's also a place where I could stick a device and I could start monitoring your driving activities. I don't need a black box. I could start monitoring your activities myself, or I could inject some really bad code in there. And we're talking chips that don't really accept a lot of code, so we're not going to be able to run anything, but I could throw gibberish out there, and it would lock up the brakes on your car. It would turn the stereo very loud on your car. And where I'm going with all of this is that I think the discussion needs to also include gadgets that we're not really thinking about as having memory or any of the things that could be corrupted. Probably most of us in this room remember having a computer virus for the first time, and it's sort of this feeling that something has been taken away from us, that someone has put something evil on our machine and we don't understand why. Just make it work. Why is it rebooting? Why is it rebooting? We're going to have those experiences now with other gadgets, and that's going to be pretty scary. So I think getting the vendors and everybody to have that dialogue with us. And I know that after the Toyota incident that I alluded to, the Transportation Safety Board is, in fact, looking at different ways that you can hack into cars. And just last week, 2 weeks ago, actually, researcher came out with, this is very clever, but I hope it never happens. He found that he could take an MP3 file, that's a music file, and download it from the internet with a piece of malware in it, a virus. And using the sync system in the car, the Bluetooth connection to his car, he could make the song play on the radio, but he would also be infecting the car with that virus. And so this creates the possibility that songs that you put on your iPod and you bring to your car may, in fact, compromise your car. And what's bad is that, I talked about authentication a moment ago, it doesn't know whether you're giving it new code because you're authorized to do that or because you're not authorized. The car doesn't know that. So you could be driving down the road and your kid could pull out an iPod and suddenly start playing a song that's infected, and your tires might lock up, the brakes might come on, something bad might happen to you, the lights might go off late at night. And this will be a horrible experience. And I hope that, as I said earlier, the manufacturers of these products do not want a bad experience. They want the cool factor. They want everybody to know that this was a positive experience. So I think they will work. Whether they engage in the conversation is a secondary thing.
Speaking of codes, we had a good question from the audience here about QR codes. What are your thoughts about QR readers on our smartphones, and do they present any special privacy concerns?
The phrase?
QR, the sort of barcode reader.
Right. The scan codes and stuff. As far as I can tell, there's not a lot you can do with those scan codes to corrupt them or compromise them. So I actually like them better than what they call NFC, near-field communications. Near-field is something that's broadcast, and I think you can tamper with broadcast, whereas taking an image of, you know, a very clever little dot or square that has markings on it is a much better approach. So what I've seen, it's hard to compromise something like that.
Let me ask you about NFC, because this is a sort of technical lingo here, but it's worth talking about for a minute because we are starting to see that introduced more and more into smartphones. Mm-hmm. I know there's been a lot of talk about Google building it into the Android system. Can you tell folks just a little bit more about that and where we're likely to see it and maybe how they should be thinking about it security-wise?
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of you have experienced wireless. You go to Starbucks and you can communicate with the internet sitting anywhere in the room. You have different degrees of communication. So you have wireless, you have RFID, which is a radio frequency tag, and that gets you down to about 30 feet away from the reader. And then you have Bluetooth, where you're even closer to the reader and more direct. The other thing about Bluetooth is it's line of sight. And then you end up with NFC, which is like almost contact, but contactless. You're just hovering over it. And so NFC is being built into the mobile phone with an idea that you will be able to hover your phone over a cash register and transfer your credit data back and forth. So you don't have to take a credit card out and swipe it. You'll just be able to communicate, a laying on of hands, as it were, with the point of sale to make your next purchase. And there are different competing standards out there. Google's got one, Android's got one, Visa's coming out one, everybody's got one, and they haven't really come together, although in Japan, they have agreed upon a standard, and also in South Korea, they have a standard there as well. So it is being done in the world. It's just the United States is a very complex system. We don't all have one bank. We don't have one credit card. It's going to take a while, I think, for the United States to really adopt that.
And speaking of mobile banking, someone wanted us to talk a little bit more about the security issues surrounding that. You do talk about that in the book.
Yeah.
You know, presumably whether we're talking about apps on our phone now or, you know, remote banking from work or from, you know, over Wi-Fi at Starbucks. How concerned should we be about that?
I get asked this question a lot. Do I do mobile banking? And the answer is no. I was one of the early adopters with online banking. I started in 1995 when it was introduced. I had been on the internet in 1994. And so I was a very early adopter of all that. For whatever reason, I felt comfortable with my computer, and I felt comfortable with the connections that I was making with my computer back then. Today, it's a lot more complex. We have a lot more gadgets out there that connect to the internet and a lot of phones out there. And I was talking about the two different types of stores that are available. Apple has this walled garden that you don't know what it is they do, but they're telling you it's secure and you trust them if you trust Apple. Google is a little different. It's like when you download it, you have all these messages, and then end of the day, do you trust Google? So with the mobile apps, I'm worried because what I've seen is people are posting, you know, a B of A app, and they're not B of A. And it's not at a point where I know it's B of A. And until that's resolved, and I was in the financial services space up until this year, I just changed jobs. And I talked to the banks, and I said, why don't you guys host the applications yourselves? And they're like, we don't want to get in the software business. We don't want to be responsible for it. So until that's all worked out, I'm a little nervous. Now, at the moment, you can't do much with mobile banking. You can check your balances. Maybe you can do a transfer. But you can't do a whole lot yet. And what's holding it back is they're concerned about the security, the banks themselves. And they're going very slow with this. But ideally, when they've resolved all this, you should be able to do everything you do online with your mobile phone. And that will be very convenient because I know there are times when I wish I had done bill pay, but I'm walking down the street and I just take out my phone and do it. But personally, I'm not there yet. Now, the other qualifier I'll put on this is I'm not necessarily dispensing security advice for everybody in this room. I think security is a personal decision. I think privacy is a personal decision. I think we all make judgment calls on where we feel safe and comfortable about information, and it's all going to be different across the board. The only thing I would say that we maybe all agree on is that we should have as much information as possible to make those decisions for ourselves.
You know, I'm also wondering a little bit about the government's role in some of this. And someone here wanted to know what the government rules are or the laws are in terms of them being allowed to access service providers and any conversations that we're having. Is that something that they still essentially need a warrant to do in some way?
Yes, you do need a warrant for the cellular companies to give over that information. And oftentimes it's in a murder investigation. I didn't put it in the book, but the Scott Peterson case, for example, featured a lot of testimony and information about phone calls that he made going from Merced over to Berkeley, and that was vital to the case. I do cite a different case in New Jersey where a woman's husband was murdered. He was found in a river in New Jersey, and in the case, the investigators, of course, looked at her fast track, or easy pass, I guess is what they call it on the East Coast, records, and they found that the SUV that was belonging to the husband had been driven that night and, oddly enough, driven to the river and back. And when she was confronted with this information, she called the transit authority and said, "Oh, there seems to be an error with that. I don't know why you show that the vehicle was out of my house that evening, but I can tell you it was sitting in the garage the whole time and everything." Well, she used her mobile phone to make the call to the transit authority. And so that was yet another piece of evidence that the prosecutors were able to present. And she is now serving a life sentence in New Jersey for the murder of her husband. So yes, you can get those records. And as I said earlier, the transit, the easy pass, the fast track, the commuter cards like Clipper are much easier to get, but I think that might change as we start moving up into the district courts and Supreme Court. It might become a lot harder as people start to realize what data can be gleaned from those records.
Let me ask you sort of a generational question here, too, because, you know, one thing that's been a clear trend the last few years, at least among certain age groups, is what I like to think of as almost this sort of radical transparency and radical sharing around things like checking in and sharing your location. Mm-hmm. And I've had this experience. I'm 42, and I've tried to get friends of mine to sign up with various, say, social sharing services, and they think I'm nuts and refuse to do it. But, you know, for a 21-year-old, I often find that the notion of constantly posting your location online or installing applications that tell all your friends where you are at any given moment and allow them to just look at your phone and say, "Oh, Bob's at Starbucks, and I'm going to go over and say hi to him." Are they crazy? Have we had any real sense of just how big a risk they're taking, or is it still too early to know?
It's still too early. There are applications like Foursquare that mark everywhere where you go, and it's even competitive. You want to be the mayor of a certain location by visiting it so many times, so many days in a row. So it's almost fun to be giving up your personal information. It's fine. I think it's a lot in the packaging. If I were to say to any one of you, "I'm going to give you a device that's going to track your whereabouts 24 hours a day and tell me exactly where you are," you're going to say no, probably. A majority of you will. It's just not something you would agree to. And yet, a lot of you have phones, and a lot of them probably have either GPS turned on or Wi-Fi, which is another way that the phone uses to identify your location. It's kind of cool to go to the map feature and see that little blue dot winking there and saying, "Wow, I'm at the corner of, you know, Mount Diablo Boulevard," and I forget what the cross street is here first, and to know exactly that's where you are, and then go see the satellite view because, wow, these are these buildings around here. Look at that. And start walking. I did this the other day. I actually walked to work, and I was watching watching the little blue dot follow me down the street, and I could see my neighbors' houses and stuff go by because I was doing the satellite view. And then occasionally I would look up and see the real world in case I stumbled into a garbage can or something along the way. I think we get so caught up in the wow factor sometimes that we forget about that. But back to your point about the young people, we're seeing some of the repercussions of that. We've had Facebook now for like 5 years or so, maybe longer. And what people of a younger generation are realizing is that some of those pictures that they took, some of those things that they freely admitted on the internet are not a great idea when you're being serious about getting a job. Because a lot of HR departments are now looking at that history and they're realizing that, you know, this could tell something about the behavior of the individual once they come into the corporate office and start working for you. So there are actually reputation companies now that will go out there and try to scrub that clean. And so we might find in a five-year period of time that location data that's being freely dispensed right now because it's cool to meet up with your friends anytime you want, that data might be recalled in some way, shape, or form. Although once you start getting it out there, it's very, very hard to recall it back in. So it's too early.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Vimosi, contributing editor of PC World and author of When Gadgets Betray Us. I have to say, you know, I just fell into this trap this weekend myself. By the way, I downloaded an app to my phone called Color.
Mm-hmm.
Color is a photo sharing program, and one of the features of it is that you turn it on and it automatically connects you with anyone around you using the application without you opting in or friending them or anything, and automatically shares the photos you're taking. So their photos all of a sudden are on your phone.
Yep. You can scroll through all the different photos. Yes.
And it's actually an amazing piece of technology, but it's also, of course, a little frightening to think that, you know, if I turn this on, who knows who's suddenly seeing my photos and whatnot. And, of course, I was showing this to some academic friends, and they said, well, did you read the terms of service? What are they doing with all that information? I was and I'd read most of your book at that point, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I put this thing on my phone without even reading that.
But it probably prompted you and said, we'll share location data.
Yes, and I just clicked okay.
You wanted Angry Birds, yes. Yeah. So there you were. Yeah.
So you know, for people like me then who still can't learn, and given the challenges that we face with some of the company's priorities, do we need government to step in and take a stronger role? And I'm also wondering, someone was asking specifically about an online privacy bill that had been introduced by Senator Kerry. You know, again, it strikes me that because we don't talk about it, there may not be a big constituency for protecting our privacy, but
actually, there is. The Federal Trade Commission appointed Ed Felton, who is a professor at Princeton University, who's been talking for years about privacy issues, as sort of a privacy czar for the Federal Trade Commission. And he's working toward a privacy regulation or requirement now for software and other entities. And I think that's a great first step. The Obama administration made it very clear that they're interested in privacy, and they went ahead and did something by having a recognized expert in the field take that position. And so he just started in the beginning of this year, so it's hard to see what direction he's planning to go in, but I bet in 6 or 9 months we'll hear more about his position and what he's planning to do.
And someone wanted to know whether the issue of spectrum factors into this. You know, are we going to be running out of it, and is that going to cause any security issues?
I can't think of how it would cause security issues, although when we started getting some of the radio bands into the emergency bands, you were starting to get some overlap, and emergency services had trouble actually making calls or getting calls, and they did some things where they moved the emergency bands elsewhere. Part of the whole analog to digital TV thing was another attempt to free up bandwidth and spectrum. So they are looking ahead. I know with the internet, we're about to run out of addresses on the internet. When the internet was first created, it thought 4 billion was enough. Well, no, it's not. And so we are, though, as I mentioned, we're currently using on the internet this IPv4 version 4, and we're we're transitioning over to IPv6, but not yet. Windows 7 recognizes it. I think the new Mac operating system recognizes it. But not everybody yet has a computer that can recognize this new standard. And when we do that, we'll have a lot more room for internet addresses.
I want to also touch briefly on the trend of cloud computing. Mm-hmm. Again, another technical term, but this is sort of that notion that increasingly, rather than storing the stuff that we have, like photos and music, on our computer, we're putting them online somewhere, which again causes us to have great convenience. You know, if I have a document stored on Google Online, I can get it on my phone or my laptop or any place I go. I don't have to worry about USB drives and
right.
disk drives and things like that. Same with email. People had Hotmail for a long time, but Gmail, Yahoo Mail, you know, all these sort of cloud storage, cloud type services. And I wonder, again, are we sort of taking a bigger risk by increasingly putting more and more of our stuff with one provider like a Google or like an Amazon or someone like that?
For that, I would say it depends who you trust. You know, who do you trust more? Look at the companies that you have out there. You got Microsoft, Apple, Google. Who do you trust? And so Amazon, for example, just announced that you can put your music files in a cloud and you can access them anywhere you want. And the immediate discussion was, well, is this safe? Is this a good idea? I just wrote an article for PC World about this, and I talk about a company called Dropbox, which is a place where you can place rather large files in the cloud. And so I'm at work, and I want to work on this file at home. I can put it in Dropbox, and I can go home, and I can access it from home very quickly and easily. I don't have to do the USB thumb drive. I don't have to do the floppy disk. I don't have to do any of the old ways of transferring large files. So it's very convenient. The thing about Dropbox is that it actually encrypts the file as it's going up there. And so in Dropbox, they don't have access to it. I forget what the answer was on Amazon, whether they encrypt it fully or not. But the danger would be is if the cloud services provider can look at your data while it's up there. And so my recommendation would be when you're considering doing any cloud services, ask about encryption or see if they talk about encryption. There's two ways that you want it to be encrypted. When you're sending the data up there, you want to use SSL, you want to be encrypted up there, and then when it's up there, is it encrypted? I know Mozilla, who does Firefox, has this new service called Sync in version 4 of Firefox, and it allows you to put your bookmarks in the cloud, which is great. As I was writing the book, I'd be using 5 or 6 different computers, and I would bookmark something because it was really cool and I want to put it in the book. And I'd get home and be like, oh, which computer is it on? So my bookmarks were all over the place. Well, they've got this new service. Now, what they do is they actually encrypt the entire bookmark file before they even send it up there. So Mozilla has no idea what you're storing in their cloud for that. And so I would recommend that you find a cloud service that doesn't allow someone else to look at your data, because potentially, if they get a lot of data up there, they could be mining it and looking at it and coming up with some interesting statistics about their users.
Yes. Well, and somebody wanted to know about the security of satellite services, I guess through internet or possibly
right.
other on-demand services or things like that.
Very good question. Satellite services are well protected. They're well protected because there's money. Okay? If everyone could rush out and get the Dish network at home, they would. But no, the satellite services want to make money. They want you to pay your bill, and they want you to subscribe. And so they're very good with encryption. And one of the researchers I talked to in the book, Adam Laurie, gave a presentation at Black Hat in Las Vegas, which, by the way, is one of the largest and best security conferences in the United States. He showed that he tried really hard to break into the satellite services. And it's really, really hard to go there. So
I want to widen the lens a little bit now because, you know, we've talked a lot about mobile and cloud, but really the book, as you alluded to, covers a wide range of devices. And I think if there's one thing that struck me in reading it is just sort of pulling back and thinking, my gosh, you know, how many devices do I need to be worried about now? You know, talk about your TV remote control, the mini bar in your hotel, and you know, your car, which you mentioned, but you know, fast track, chips in our pets and our kids. You know, the idea of someone hacking my dog hadn't really occurred to me.
Yeah, there's a great paper called "My Cat Has a Virus." It's wonderful about how you can corrupt databases with your cat. So,
But I'm wondering, first off, you know, the feeling I could quickly have then is if I start thinking about and cataloging, you know, the whole list of things, smart meters, you know, anything that now has a chip, you know, someday, you know, all the appliances in my house are going to be connected to the smart grid, and then are people going to be hacking into my refrigerator and my oven? And I mean, it sounds goofy, and yet...
But if they can turn off your refrigerator, that's going to be a problem. If they're going to turn off the power during a cold, cold evening, that's going to be a problem.
So, you know, first off, I mean, as consumers, again, is there any advice you can give us on kind of having the, I guess, the proper perspective? Because you could, I could also see very easily going over to the whole other side and just being infinitely paranoid everywhere you turn and thinking, you know, is this thing spying on me? Is, you know, you're wearing the tinfoil hat next thing you know? And so, so how do we sort of achieve that proper skepticism without just, you know, slipping into lunacy, I guess?
I want to thank you for the context question. Yes, I go through a lot of examples of breaking things in the book, and I don't necessarily fix everything. And it, you just have to put it in context. How likely is this going to happen to you? Probably not. I'm trying to raise a dialogue here and just say that these things are possible, and that when you get a gadget, when you rip open the box and take it out and whatever, think for a moment. Maybe I should check the configurations. Maybe I should look at it a little more. Okay, now I can start playing it. But the point is just pause a bit. And it's all context. There's a lot of data being collected right now. There's a place, and I mentioned it in the book, in Nevada, where the NSA is going to build a huge data repository and try to get as much information, fingerprints, biometrics, anything they can pull together about every one of us as an anti-terrorism control. Realistically, is someone going to look through all of that data? I don't know about that. I mean, we're not yet at the point where we can crunch all of those numbers and come up with algorithms that are going to give us some meaningful results from that. So at the moment, I'm not too worried about it. The other thing is that sometimes I have data stored with Amazon, or I have data stored with Google, or I have data stored with my credit card. They don't have the whole picture of who I am. You know, I have multiple email accounts. And so I have messages going in different directions. People know me at school. People know me at work. People know me in different places. They don't know my whole picture because they don't have all of my email addresses. So I'm not too terribly worried about it. And, you know, for a security guy, I probably make some mistakes too. I probably have some location data turned on my apps that I don't necessarily know how to turn off myself. But I'm not sleepless because of that. I just know in the context of things, it's probably not going to hurt me personally. But again, let's have a dialogue and let's just start thinking about these things a little more rather than just blindly taking the next gadget that comes our way.
You know, I'm glad someone asked this question about Wi-Fi, because I'd like to spend just a couple minutes talking about this as well. I had a chance about a year ago to drive around Silicon Valley with a security engineer from Motorola, where he was just sort of demonstrating to me basically how easy it was for him to read Wi-Fi signals from all over the place. We drove up to a Starbucks. Mm-hmm. We just parked in front of random office buildings that had, you know, internal Wi-Fi, people's houses. It's pretty startling when you sit there and see how easy it is for him to take a piece of code off the internet and just sort of watch this data flowing out of people's homes or offices. So let me just ask you in general, you know, I have a pretty good sense of how vulnerable that is, but starting with people's homes, are people, at least there, taking the proper security measures? Again, do you find that they're sort of doing the, you know, the just opening up the box and sticking it in and letting it go?
Well, I live in San Francisco, and it's pretty dense in my neighborhood, a lot of homes and stuff. And a few years ago, I would go online Wi-Fi, and I would see that my neighbors did not secure their connections. I could easily jump on my neighbor's connection, and he wouldn't know that I was draining bandwidth from his Wi-Fi. But now I find that that's not the case. And some of that has to do with the people that are bringing the Wi-Fi. For example, if you have Comcast or AT&T, I'm not doing an advertisement for these companies. I'm just saying that now when they install them in the home, they do take the precaution of putting some Wi-Fi protection. WPA, WPA2 is what you want to have when you're setting up your router. Also, the router manufacturers want to make it easier for you. And so I know Linksys, made by Cisco, they have a one-button setup that allows you to secure it right there, and it automatically does things behind the scenes. I'm not a big fan of automatically behind the scenes, but I recognize that not everybody knows as much about software and things. So anything that gets more people secure, I'm all in favor of it. So now when I look out at my neighborhood, at least my neighborhood, I find that, you know, people are secure. When you go to a hotspot, though, when you go to Starbucks or when you go to the airport, you need to rein in your behavior, I think. We have public and private behaviors. There are certain things we do at home that we would never do out on the street in public. And I think the same is true with the internet. And so when you're sitting in an airport waiting area and you're accessing a free public Wi-Fi, don't be checking your bank balance. Don't be putting your credit card number and things like that. It's open. It's open for a reason, because they want more people to join and have access to the internet. They want it to be convenient. Wait till you get to your hotel room. Wait till you get home or your office where it's more secure. And if you have to communicate with your work, hopefully environments today give you VPN or tunneling where it's secure and you're at least connecting through their network and not the free Wi-Fi. So,
and by the way, should we assume, let's say if we go to the community library in Lafayette and boot up our laptop and go on the Wi-Fi, should we just assume by default that because I didn't need to log on, because I didn't need a password or some code, that it's probably pretty wide open and I should just sort of take the utmost precautions?
Yes, that's usually an indicator. I know some Wi-Fi cafes will hand you a password if you purchase something as terms of their, you know, agreement with you. But even then, how many other people in the room have that same password? And who are those other people in the room? And do any of them work for interesting companies? Or maybe they're out of work and they just know a lot about the internet. So again, public and private behavior. And I would recommend that when you're out in public, you know, rein it in a little bit.
So again, going back to this other spectrum of devices, you know, again, it seems like there's so much out there to think about as a consumer. And there's so many new devices and new things getting this stuff baked into it all the time. Is there a good way that, you know, we can continue to educate ourselves? Is there a resource that sort of says, you know, here are some of the latest products that you may not have really thought about, but maybe you ought to think about, is there a chip or software or some RFID tag giving off information?
Well, I can only think of, you know, what I do for a living and the people that write about the security stuff. And hopefully, you know, mainstream audiences like you will come to events like mine and learn more about what's going on with the chips and the security that's out there. And the people will start to take it a little more seriously. I would hope that we don't have a bad event, a Melissa virus, something that shuts off our gadgets that we depend on, certainly something that shuts off the power in our home, you know, because of a smart grid accident. I would hope that we stop it before then. So I don't have a great answer for that, but just continue to be aware.
And, you know, speaking of events and viruses, I mean, we hear a lot about cyber warfare, cyber attacks. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's really directed at us, or is that more tending to be directed at big institutions or governments or corporations?
Well, that's an interesting question. There was an example in Estonia a couple years ago where some Russian nationalists decided to take down the Estonian government because of a political issue. And what they did was they shut off access to government services. And what that meant in Estonia was you couldn't pay for bread at the grocery store. You couldn't buy gas at the gas station. So it did trickle down. It did impact the average civilian. Even though it was a political dispute going on at a higher level, it affected the person on the street. And for several days, they worked very hard to resist this, what they call a sin flood attack and various denial of service attacks, so that they could get the internet back up and running and so that basic services could start up again. So there's a potential of that. We're a large country, and I don't think you'd see a similar thing. We're also not as dependent on the internet yet in this country. So I don't think we're there yet, but who knows?
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question. But on that issue of sort of nations and our dependency, I'm surprised to hear you say I would have thought we were more dependent on the internet than some other countries.
Well, I just hearken back to the Estonia example. It didn't occur to me until I talked to some of the researchers who went over there to help the computer emergency response team, the CERT team over there, and mitigate that. And the daily lives focus around identity cards they all carry, and those identity cards grant them access to services. And when you cut off that authentication with the government that tells them who you are, you cut off access to those services. So it can impact us, but we're not at that level yet in the United States.
All right, our thanks to Robert Vimosi, contributing editor of PC World and author of When Gadgets Betray Us. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Chris O'Brien, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.